It takes courage to accept the things we cannot change. And there is freedom to be found in surrender. You probably know Reinhold Niebuhr's prayer, "God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference." Niebuhr first wrote a version of this prayer in the years leading up to World War II. He was a public theologian who wrote beautifully about human nature, democracy, and justice. And he returned to these words repeatedly over the years in his writings. But that's not how the prayer became so well known. It entered the national psyche when it began to be used at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step groups. I love that this prayer begins with surrender, just as 12-step programs do. The first step of Alcoholics Anonymous is an admission of powerlessness. The words are, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable." I need to say that I am not an expert on 12-step programs, nor am I a member of AA. I'm also aware of the tradition that discourages anyone from lifting themselves up as an authoritative public interpreter of AA principles. I speak only from my own direct and indirect experience this morning, and I offer only my own perspective. The structures, practices, and stories related to AA and other similar programs have had a profound impact on my life. I try to preach on the subject of addiction at least once a year because recovery is one of the core spiritual tasks of our communal life. 2,000 years ago, the Buddha identified craving and clinging as the root of human suffering. Addiction is an extreme form of a spiritual affliction that every human being wrestles with to some extent. We want life to turn out a certain way, and when it doesn't, we try to manipulate circumstances and exert control. We live in a time of compulsive consumerism that is devouring communities and our planet, and we can't seem to stop ourselves. And we're living through an addiction epidemic that is ravaging the country, especially the Northeast where we live. I read an article in the New York Times recently, which contains some shocking statistics. Drug overdoses are now the leading cause of death for Americans under 50. Roughly 64,000 people died from overdoses in 2016, a 22% increase over the previous year. And New Hampshire has the highest rate of synthetic opioid-related deaths per capita in the country. It matters that we take up the spiritual task of recovery as a people and as people, because an epidemic has landed in our laps. The journey of recovery unfolds into blessings, but it is a hard journey to start. It begins with the courage to face the truth that we are not in control. Who knew that surrender required so much boldness and so much bravery? Here's a quote from AA's Big Book. "Who cares to admit defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. It is truly awful to admit. But in AA, we soon take quite another view. We perceive that only through utter defeat are we able to take our first steps toward liberation and strength. Our admissions of personal powerlessness finally turn out to be firm bedrock upon which happy and purposeful lives may be built. The principle that we shall find no enduring strength until we first admit complete defeat is the main taproot from which our society has sprung and flowed." I have experienced something like this in my own life. When I was in my 20s, I dated a man who drank too much. At the time, I couldn't say with certainty whether or not he was an alcoholic, but I was often troubled by his relationship to drinking. We fought about it a lot. He would say that he couldn't be an alcoholic because he was able to do his job well, or because he didn't drink hard alcohol, or because he didn't drink as much as his own father had back in the day. I responded by bargaining. I would say, "Can you just not do it every day? Can you skip 2 or 3 days a week? It's the dailiness that gets to me." so he would agree, begrudgingly. He was often angry on the days he didn't have any beer, and I often walked on eggshells. And then the agreement would just break down, and things would go back to the way they had been. He was a good man, a kind man, who loved me very much and changed my life with his love, but we didn't make it. We lasted as a couple for almost 5 years before we broke up, and I don't know whether his drinking was the main reason we didn't last, but it is certainly one of them. Several years later, I began a new relationship with another person whose drinking made me uncomfortable, but I took a different route, and it made all the difference. I had learned something from that first go-round. The second time, I was able to admit to myself that I had no power over my partner's choices. I was powerless to change his relationship to alcohol, but I could claim responsibility for my own life. Once I accepted this difficult reality as fact, my options opened. I found freedom and peace that did not depend on his actions or choices. I learned how to be genuinely supportive, and I learned to let go of the arrogant assumption that I could fix him or manipulate the situation into something workable. I was, after all, the only person in the relationship that I could change. As it turns out, he did stop drinking not long after we got together. He's been sober for many years now. Most mornings, he's the first person I see, my dear husband, Chris. He was lucky in many ways. He was aware of addiction in his family history, and he wanted a lot out of life. He was instinctively passionate about life. He believed in himself and his dreams, and that helped get him through. As he said it, I spent years trying different ways of being a casual drinker, and then finally I realized I couldn't. And even if it was possible, it just wasn't worth the effort. He said, I had more important things to do with my life than figure out whether I could have an occasional glass of wine. So I stopped. It wasn't exactly that simple as you might guess, but it was easier for him than for many. Certainly easier than it was for me to stop fretting about other people's lives and take responsibility for my own. And I couldn't find my way to that alone. I needed the support I found in community. I needed to speak my own truths and hear myself in the stories others told. It was a revelation to listen to people who had found freedom and peace in their lives, irrespective of whether their loved ones were successful in recovery. It was transformative to be part of a community grounded in the faith that a new way of being was possible, a new way of being that did not depend on the ability to control external circumstances. A community of memory and hope, a community of faith and freedom. We can be such a place too. We are such a place. We gather to grow spiritually, to mature in our understanding of the world, to mature in our ways of moving through the world. We support each other here. We give one another the space to discover our own truths and to learn to live by them. At our very best, we hold each other accountable with respectful compassion. We cast a vision for a more hopeful future, even as we acknowledge the suffering that is a natural part of life. There is strength in community. I love the story of Maggie Brooke, who grew up on an Indian reservation where nearly everyone over 12 drank regularly to drunkenness. She says, 20 years ago, a woman named Lois lived in a neighboring band within our tribe. Once a week, I went the few miles to her community and babysat her little ones. But after 2 months, I started to wonder, what could Lois possibly be doing every Tuesday night? There's not much to do around these villages. So one evening after Lois left to go to the meeting lodge, I packed up the children and went over to find out. We looked through a window in the lodge and saw a big circle of chairs, all neatly in place, with Lois sitting in a chair all by herself. The chairs in the circle were empty. I was really curious, you know. So when Lois came home that evening, I asked her, Lois, what are you doing every Tuesday night? And she said, I told you weeks ago I've been holding AA meetings. So I asked her, what do you mean you're holding meetings? I went over there tonight with the children and looked through the window. We watched you sitting in that circle of chairs alone. Lois got quiet. I wasn't alone, she said. I was there with the spirits and the ancestors, and one day our people will come. Every week, Maggie Brooke continues, Lois set up those chairs neatly in a circle, and for 2 hours she just sat there. No one came to those meetings for a long time, and even after 3 years there were only a few people in the room. But 10 years later, the room was filled with people. The community began turning around. People began to rid themselves of alcohol. I felt so inspired by Lois that I couldn't sit still watching us poison ourselves. One evening, Maggie Brooke took a seat in that circle, and everything changed. Thanks to Lois, a future, not only for herself but for her people, a future became possible. There is so much respect embedded in the circle Lois made. She made a container in which healing could happen, in which a new future could be born. She helped forge a community where insight and transformation could emerge organically from the wisdom of the group and the sacred presence of the ancestors. And she had the courage to wait without trying to force the group to coalesce before its time. Lois's forbearance reminds me of some of my favorite lines from T.S. Eliot's poem, East Coker. This poem is one of those to which I return year after year. It's kind of a personal sacred text. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith. But the faith and the hope and the love are all in the waiting. A little later in the poem, he writes, you say I am repeating something I have said it before. I shall say it again. Shall I say it again? In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are from where you are not, you must go by a way wherein there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not. And what you don't know is the only thing you know. And what you own is what you do not own. And where you are is where you are not. It's an invitation to let go and live into a whole new, as yet unimagined, way of being. We surrender. We let go. We face the facts of our lives as they are and relinquish the illusion of control. We take the brave step of admitting defeat and step out on faith into the unknown, buoyed by the support of good companions and the vision of a brighter future for ourselves and our community. Just for today, may we embrace the power of surrender and trust in the possibility of recovery and health. Amen.